We might say the meanest things. Sometimes we're not much company. There's no rearranging. Our writing remains the same. We remain the same. And as far as we're concerned, you belong to us. Pop Dose.
Sup, fuckers? It's episode 18 of the Pop Dose podcast. I'm Dave Lifton. We've got something a little different for you this month. When we did the last show, our original intention was to preface the interview with Gorman Bichard, the director of the documentary about The Replacements, with Jason, Jeff, and I discussing some of our experiences as music fans. We're going to talk for about an hour or so, and I was going to edit that down to half an hour, and that would be a really good intro for the interview. But what happened was that we started out with our usual goofing off, and we did about 45 minutes of that, and then we wound up going on the topic for about another hour. And there was so much good stuff in that discussion that rather than chop that up, we decided to save it for this month and use the opening silliness as the intro to episode 17. So here is that segment. Enjoy it. I think it's a very interesting discussion that also touches on a lot of things about music fandom, and it does contain what may be the best mom joke in the entire history of the podcast so far. And I will be back on the flip side with an endorsement and the wrap-up. And the first question to you guys is, what album inspired a sea change in your tastes? In other words, was there anything in particular that caused you to open up your mind to a genre that you previously didn't like or weren't particularly familiar with?
Wow.
Good question.
That's a great question, and I'm not sure I know the answer to that.
Yeah, I don't know if I do. I don't know if there was any band that really got me thinking about a different genre, but there were bands that got me to think about the way I listened to music in terms of like the way I collected it and the way I followed it, you know. That changed me from being a casual listener of an artist to being, you know, I don't know. When you talk about, you know, fanaticism or being like a diehard fan, you know, it's very close to being an obsessive to me. So that's what I think about. I think about the bands that I listened to that turned me into an obsessive person where like I had to have everything.
Interesting. For me, it was a Document by REM.
Huh.
Because before then, like, I thought of music as being in two groups. You know, you had the mainstream and you had, you know, the weird stuff. And, you know, there were bands like Talking Heads and U2 that became, you know, really popular in the mid-80s. But I hadn't given thought to the fact that, you know, these bands started out on college radio and alternative radio, and they worked their way into the mainstream from there. I do remember in high school trying on several occasions to listen to WLIR, which was Long Island's alternative station.
Right.
And just not getting any of it. But just as I was getting to college, Document was released. And then the one I love was all over the place. And by the end of the freshman year, I was thinking, maybe this weird stuff's not so weird after all. And Peter Buck has always said that REM were the acceptable edge of the unacceptable stuff.
They were very melodic.
Right, and it was, and it did have, you know, the jangling Rickenbacker guitar, and, you know, by Life's Rich Pageant, when they got Scott Litt to give them a little bit more of an accessible sound, you know, he had produced the they got Don Gaiman for that album, who had produced John Mellencamp's Scarecrow. They very specifically wanted to kind of become a little more commercial but still stay within that kind of framework of the sound they had on the previous few albums.
Don't you think Stipe was always the least accessible element of their sound anyway?
Yeah, very much so. I mean, he even said that.
And it's only because you can't tell what the fuck he's saying.
Right.
Right. And there were times where, you know, he even said that he was just making wordless vocals.
Yeah.
He was just making sounds on some of those in some spots, and only later did he, when they had to do it for copyright purposes, actually write lyrics to them.
Huh. I feel like now he's much more willfully strange than he was back then. I think that bands like the Talking Heads represent a much more artful collision of the quote unquote alternative and pop mainstream. David Byrne was trying to be weird. But he was trying to be weird in a way that suburban kids would hear.
Right. And in the framework of top 40 radio, there was a place for weirdos, you know, just like a very small niche that they kind of fit very nicely into, partially because their music was so good.
I miss that niche.
Yeah. Well, now everything's a niche, you know, weirdness in itself is a niche, you know, and you know, like the mainstream or the monoculture is just fucking Black Eyed Peas and, you know, dance pop crossover shit.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, everything's a niche, but there's still a top 40, and
right,
it makes me sad.
Jeff, is there anything for there? I mean, like what, you know, we've talked about you with like where you get really into singer-songwriters. What was the one that opened up that door for you?
Open up the door to singer-songwriters? That was probably, I mean, the first artist that I really cared about at all was Billy Joel. And I've been thinking about this a lot over the last few days. It's funny because I was just talking to Mike Errico for the interview I did with him for Pop Dose. And he and I were talking about, I think this might be the only fan letter I've ever sent. No, that isn't true. The first fan letter I ever sent was to Billy Joel.
Really?
Yeah, I was, I think I was like 10 years old, 9 or 10 years old, and sent him this long, you know, obviously handwritten, impassioned letter about how much I loved his music. And I got back a form letter. This was back, I don't know if you guys remember, but he used to have a fan club called the Root Beer Rag.
Yep.
The newsletter was called the Root Beer Rag, yeah. So if you wrote to him, you got a form letter that included the story of how when Billy Joel was a kid, he wrote a letter to the Beatles and was so disappointed by the form letter he got from the Beatles.
So he decided to make a better form letter?
Yeah. And at the end, there's like a little sales pitch for, you know, I forget how much it cost to join the Root Beer Rag, but right. Yeah.
Then he steamed off the stamp and sold it to buy booze or something?
I don't think I signed up ever for that newsletter.
No, I never did either.
But that's the first hardcore fan experience I ever had was really loving Billy Joel when all my friends were really into Prince and Michael Jackson and Madonna. You know, I had no idea that Billy Joel was a million-selling superstar. He to me was always sort of the underdog.
That's weird, because it wasn't until I guess got to college that I realized that he was largely hated by critics.
Yeah, I think we've talked about this before. Well, Dave, you had your Long Island blinders on.
Exactly.
You know, the same as I did.
Right.
You know.
What interests me is, given that all three of us have, to some extent, interacted with some of our musical heroes, what interests me is sort of the underbelly of fandom and the risk as you begin writing about these guys and talking with them that they will not live up to your sort of lofty ideal of who they are.
That's one of the main reasons why I never want to meet Bruce Springsteen.
Except you totally want to meet Bruce Springsteen.
Well, yeah, but I mean, first there's the fact that like I'm like half a foot taller than he is, and he's a guy who just is so huge in my life, and you know, he's like could practically blow me without leaving his knees, which you know,
which you haven't thought about at all.
Right. No, I've thought about blowing him. I can't imagine Bruce blowing me. That's what I was getting at. But you stepped on my joke. Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
But there's also the idea of, you know, I said, if I ever meet him, like, I just want to say thank you and walk away. But, yeah, like, the whole idea, I mean, yeah, I have spoken to Richard Thompson and Paul Westerberg and some of those guys who are very big, but not like
And was it a fulfilling experience for you?
Very much so. Richard Thompson, I met him on a couple of times after shows, and he's very funny. I mean, you know, like you say to him, I think I gave up playing guitar, you know, midway through your set, you know, and he'll just say, yeah, so did I.
Well, it's got to be hard for a guy like that because he must hear things like that all the time. And I
And that's just why, like, if I just said, like, thank you to Bruce Springsteen, he would know exactly what that all meant.
Yeah.
You know, and I don't need to say, oh, is this and this and this and, you know. And no, he knows all that shit. He's heard it from another
show. I don't see how any of these people can really live up to our expectations. And I find now more that I want to meet these people less.
What was it like for you emotionally talking to Richard Marx? I know that sounds like an asshole question, but it's a serious question because I've been through this a number of times, and
he was great. He was great because I think he's a genuinely decent person and is very grounded and down to earth. But also, you know, it's not like, I don't know, you know, it's not like I met him on the street when he wasn't being Richard Marx. You know what I mean? Although I think it seems to me like his show persona and his non-show persona are very similar. You know, they're both very grounded people. But it's like if I met Richard Marx on the street and he was with his family and I went to say hello to him, maybe he wouldn't have been as friendly. You know, I did an interview with him, so he knows what the game is. So I don't know if that's truly accurate. I mean, it was not like I was in his, you know, it wasn't like I was walking around his backyard. You know, like you and Christopher, you know, like you and Christopher Cross.
Well, that's a whole other story.
Right.
But what I think, like, I feel like when you're doing an interview like that, even if it isn't the express purpose of the piece that you're writing, kind of your goal as a fan is to try and sort of communicate your affection and your knowledge of that artist's work through your questions. And I think that's really, really hard. And that is part of what makes it so unfulfilling often to talk to these guys. Part of it is just that they're regular people and that they tend to be assholes just like the rest of us. But part of it is also that it's very hard to express the level of meaning that someone's music takes on if you are that kind of a fan.
It's funny that you say that because you're especially good at it.
Oh, I don't think so at all.
No, that's true. Who did you interview last week that I was talking to you about that I didn't know him at all, but your love of,
was it Lee Feldman?
Yes.
Well, you know, like Lee Feldman, it was easy because I admire his music and I think that his career is fascinating, but I wouldn't say that I'm a huge, sorry, Lee, I wouldn't say I'm a huge fan. not the same. Like, okay, when I was 18, one of my first big interviews was with Peter Cetera.
Okay.
Yeah. And I was extremely nervous. Mm-hmm. And
so this was 1992, probably.
Yeah. Yes.
Probably still not. Still probably a fairly.
He was still riding high.
Well-known name, but he wasn't really having any charts. No chart hits.
Well, he was having Adult Contemporary, wasn't he?
Was that After All song? When did that come out?
No, that was 88. This was the first record that came out that didn't really do anything.
Did he know? But that was yet to be known, right?
Exactly.
Okay.
But, you know, when I was in fifth grade or whatever, Peter Cetera was the shit.
Right.
So I was extremely nervous. And that was the first time I experienced sort of that disconnect that, like, listening to music is a really intimate experience, but talking to somebody about that music, you know, music to them is it's a creative act, but it's also a job. And so is talking to people who love your music, as shitty as that sounds.
Right.
Somebody right. like Springsteen, even if you try to distill all your feelings into thank you, which is about as good as you're going to get, he probably hears that even a lot.
Yeah.
You just can't express unless you like tie the guy up and put him in your trunk for a month.
I haven't thought of that, but I'd love a car.
You can't really express what it all means.
Right.
Right. But I just think of those two words, like, you know, I mean, he knows his effect on his fan base, and I think he's been really genuine about that, about understanding that.
Dave, have you ever done an interview that really made you nervous?
Yeah, well, Dave Marsh talking about Springsteen, for starters, when the On Tour book came out.
And is that because you're a big fan of his writing or just because you didn't want to be out gunned?
Part of both. Well, obviously, I'm talking to Springsteen fan number one. Actually, Springsteen fan number two, if John Landau was probably the first. But, you know, a guy who has access into the inner circle. And his wife picked up the phone, and his wife is Springsteen's co-manager as well. So, you know, but he even said, you know, you ask some really good questions. And he really enjoyed the interview, which thrilled me. I, like, leapt up in the air when I hung up the phone.
Yeah, everybody wants to hear that, you know.
Yeah. The two that were most intimidating for me originally, the first one going in was very intimidating. And Dave Marsh is one of the first interviews I did for my old podcast. But the second one was Bob Mould.
I'm not a huge fan, but I've heard that he could be a real dick, so I'd be intimidated going in.
That's what I was worried about. And I made sure not to say, so, you know, I know you and Grant, you know, did this benefit a while ago. Are you guys thinking about getting back together? I knew not to go there. But he was very nice and funny and accommodating and warm and all that good stuff. The single most intimidating interview I've ever done is John Hodgman.
Really?
Because he is always on and always quick.
You know,
and he will just burn the living shit out of you.
Wow.
I don't think I told you this, but I saw that guy. He's friends with Bill Childs. And when I did my guest DJ stint on
Spare the Rock,
he was in the studio.
Really?
He wasn't in our particular studio, but, you know, it's a radio station, so there's windows everywhere. And, yeah, he came in with his kids, and, yeah.
Yeah, he's a very nice and funny guy, but if you just give him an opening, he's going to nail you. And he's just that funny and that quick. I had said something about, you know, it was just like one of those parts in the interview where everything's going well, and you just like start like having like a little conversation with the guy.
Yeah.
And he said something like, oh, you know, I mentioned something about like property values in D.C. being too tough, being too high to get a bigger apartment than I had. You know, it was just a little banter. And he said, well, you should try. This was not too long after he started on The Daily Show. And he said, well, you should go on television. He's like, because that's a pretty good way to earn a living. And I said, well, I do kind of have aspirations towards being a comedy writer. And he said, oh, I see where you're going now. I can't help you. You know, but that's how incredibly quick he is.
Right.
He is very much that character that you see on The Daily Show. That's not a character, is what I'm saying.
Have you listened to his new podcast?
Oh yeah, I've been a fan of The Sound of Young America for a really long time.
That was I'm talking about Judge John Hodgman.
Yeah, that comes from The Sound of Young America.
Okay,
yeah, that's very very funny, and that's exactly what it's like interviewing him. You talk to him, and then he just kills you.
Let him go.
Yeah,
Jason, how many interviews have you done?
Two.
Really?
I have not. Well, no. Right? Well, you know, I mean, recently, in recent years, like phoners, I've done two. I've not been terribly interested in speaking to people unless I know enough about them already. You know, like our colleague Will Harris. He can take any subject. He can take any person and sound like he's been following them for years.
Right, and he's great at making them feel open and starts getting a good rapport with them.
Yeah, and he asks them. He doesn't ask them the typical stupid questions. And he know. I mean, back when we were pitched on Jonathan Brook, I wanted to review the concert, but I didn't want to interview her because I felt like I just didn't know enough. And so I asked Will if he wanted to do it, and he said yes if you are willing to do the transcription on it. And you know, he did his research. And he had a whole bunch of questions for her that she had never been asked. That's great.
Yeah,
you know, that's good.
That is great.
That's good interviewing. Yeah. I would rather focus on, you know, the people that I really like. But I mean,
Will's also done a lot of junkets. You know, like he's done interviews with other people in the room, and for people like us, there's still that illusion that you're having a private conversation with someone who, on some level, has meant something to you.
Right. Right. Right.
That's difficult.
This is the lift. Just like it is. Lift them. Love him, baby. Just like it is.
Okay, next question.
Sure.
Okay. Which act that you like goes against the grain of your tastes? And I'm not necessarily talking about guilty pleasures, which we've talked about before, but, you know, things that surprise people when they find out that you like it.
Hmm.
That's another good question I'm not sure I have an answer for.
Well, this is working out swimmingly.
Jason likes Slayer.
Yeah, right. No, but what generally comes to my mind when I think of that is back in, just before I discovered REM, I had a bit of a prog phase.
Oh, Dave.
I was young. you know, it's like you discover classic rock and you think that everything that was done, you know, in this period of time was the greatest ever, and the fact that I was also like really starting to play guitar, but I moved away from virtually all of that.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Did you both get that press release today saying that Styx and Yes are going on tour together this summer?
I didn't get that one.
I didn't get that yesterday, but it was sent a while ago.
I just got one today.
It was mentioned last week, and I said something about you know, the idea of a supergroup forming like Yessix or something like that. But Yes, you know, the three albums, the Yes album, Fragile, and Close to the Edge, those are great fucking records.
Nope.
No, they're not.
Yeah, the lyrics are shitty and John Anderson's voice is kind of, you know, wimpy. But just musically, I think it's really accessible, and at the same time, that it does have like these really long suites.
They were always more grounded in pop songcraft than like
right.
Emerson, Lake, and Palmer. But
right, that's why those have kind of stayed with me more than, you know, like the more I try is like, all right, I kind of like Brain Salad Surgery. Let me see Tarkus, and it's like,
listen to Tarkus, Dave.
Exactly. Well, we're talking 25 fucking years ago, you know. What the hell did I know?
So but it's a concept album about an armadillo tank. You know,
and even that's better than Love Beach, or Works. You know, but that's what I'm saying. You know, you kind of like something, and you have some of those things that made it onto the radio, and you think, okay, do I like this? And you kind of go a little further, and you go, no, I really don't. But I think that, you know, I never got into King Crimson, even though, like, of all the prog bands, they were the ones that were critically admired.
I think that's because they their sound is tough to get into.
Yeah. But, you know, yes, you know, I think Steve Howe is just a brilliant fucking guitarist. He should have been...
Undeniably.
Yeah, he should have been in a jazz band. He should have been Pat Metheny. But he was, you know, put in these other... types of situation, you know, in these other things, but he also had like that country influence, with that instrumental, the clap that he did. yeah, that was on the Yes album, you know that, but that's a really good, that's a really good and incredibly difficult to play instrumental. What the fuck are you laughing at? You're suppressing a mother joke, aren't you? I hate you fuckers.
So proud of you right now. Never let it be said that the words "the clap" can be uttered during the Pop Dose podcast without everything falling to pieces.
I should have said Mood for a Day. I should have talked about Mood for a Day. But yeah, I mean, there was, you know, really good musicianship, and like you said, it was rooted in choruses and melodies and pop songcraft, even if, you know, they were writing about battleships.
Bluebirds and fairies.
Yeah. Shining, flying, purple wolfhound, show me where you are. But, you know, I see the appeal just really of those three records. Jason.
Yes.
Do you like have something like the cover of London Calling tattooed on your back or something to go against your soft rock?
No, I'm trying to. I've been half trying to think of that and half trying to think about what other questions you've loaded up that you haven't given us. The question is advanced, but you magically have
trying to prepare yourself in advance,
right? Well, I the first one I told you specifically was coming. I specifically mentioned that.
No, I
when I mentioned the topic.
I guess I'm a little boring, or a lot boring. I mean, or maybe I'm just limited in my thinking right now, but...
There's nothing in your collection that would surprise us?
Not anything really of interest, I don't think. I mean, you know, I mean, what's the genre I listen to the most of is the New Age stuff I listen to go to sleep, but I wouldn't consider myself... like a fan of that because I'm asleep by track four, you know. But no, I'm not deliberately trying to be boring. I just don't know if I have anything. I mean, my tastes are pretty predictable.
I mean, you like what you like.
You don't have like a punk band or something that you like, or just
no,
something that's kind of like big and stupid and.
No, I don't think so.
And not sensitive or.
I don't think so. I mean. No. I mean, growing up, I listened to pop music. I listened to Michael Jackson and George Michael and Billy Joel and, you know, light stuff. And I think for my parents, even The Who was probably too heavy when I got into The Who, you know. But
you're a huge fucking Who fan.
I am a huge Who fan. Yeah. But I wouldn't consider that so far, you know, off the beaten path. So, no, I don't think I have anything. I'll set that question out.
Okay. Wow. Jeff?
Well, I don't really have a picture of what people expect me to listen to.
No, but you have very, I mean you're incredibly diverse and the things that you manage to say that like that you have and that you are so easily able to talk about always scares the living shit out of me.
Really?
Well, just like, you know, you like in some of your reviews where you'll just like pull something out of a hat and it just shows that you would, you knew like in the last one, we were talking about like REO Speedwagon albums and Foreigner albums from the late 80s that nobody bought, but you knew fairly well. You know,
I have a fondness for albums that nobody bought.
Right. But I mean is there anything that, you know, so you have distinct tastes that you listen to. And things that you look for in albums and things that you look for in bands. And what is it that you just put on, you know, and there is like a very strong lyrical quality to a lot of what you like.
I started at the same place that Jason started. I mean, and then probably we all started. We all came from the Fertile Crescent of Billy Joel's piano.
Right. But
that sounds awful.
But it beats being the Fertile Crescent of Billy Joel's loins. But I mean, is there something that is lyrically dumb that you like that maybe
lyrically that
you can just put aside and just kind of like enjoy because it's music and because it's just kind of ridiculous and not and without the nostalgic bent to it?
Well,
or
like
maybe like a synth pop band or something like that.
Yeah, when I was working for Bullseye, rest in peace, I became kind of the designated pop guy on the staff, and so I'd have to review, Britney Spears or Rihanna. And I think there's sort of a reflexive disdain for that type of music, and then I think there's also a reflexive kind of post-ironic appreciation for it. But what I don't think there is a lot of is a genuine appreciation for the solid melodic craft that goes into what I think are the really good songs in that genre. Like was it last year or the year before when Party in the USA was a hit? Was it last year?
No, I think it was the year before that.
Ah, everything blurs together.
But I remember how much you liked that song.
I did. I thought it was catchy, and really well. I think it was as well put together. Like I remember when I was younger listening to Cheap Trick and really feeling like even though the way those songs are put together, it's very much A plus B equals C. Like, you know exactly where they're going to go. And part of the thrill of listening to songs like that is seeing how they put those pieces together.
Sure.
And I felt the same way about Party in the USA.
But see, what I like about Cheap Trick is that their bridges will often go in very weird situations, in very different directions. Like I think of Dream Police.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like a kind of like the perfect example of that.
They gave themselves a little extra room for experimentation, but I think that part of the thrill of power pop in general is feeling that expected resolution.
Right.
Right. Going off in different directions and then still coming home with that slam and chorus.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Or modulation, or, you know, just like an old, well, a cheap trick, basically a cheap songwriting trick that you know is going to come, and that they give it to you anyway.
Right.
And it just hits you in the right spot.
Right. It feels comfortable.
Mm-hmm. Right. And I think that's what guys like, well, who's writing for the Disney girls now? Is it Robbie Neville's one of them, right?
Matthew Wilder.
Matthew, that those guys in the trenches, that's something that they understand very well.
Right, yeah, good point.
So that is probably the most lyrically stupid music that I have any kind of fondness for. I have some Miranda Cosgrove songs on my iPod. She's the star of...
iCarly?
Yeah, iCarly. I was trying to think of the network that it's on, and I'm not really sure. But yeah, she's on a show called iCarly. I guess she must be a Disney thing, right?
Is she the one that was in School of Rock?
Oh yeah, right. That was her. She was the she was quite a bit younger, but yes, yeah. She was. She was in School of Rock.
Yeah.
Anyway, she can't really sing, but she's got some good songwriters working for her, and it doesn't bother me.
He built this website. He built this website with
I got a question. This is more about being a fan in terms of being the kind of fan that collects things, and like when you're into a band and you suddenly become that person that's got to have everything. Is it better now than it was then?
Do you feel? I don't feel that same urge anymore. Do you?
No,
I don't. But I think this is about the internet, because
right.
when we were kids, it was like you knew the basics. You knew the basics about your favorite band or artist, but you didn't really know when the next album was coming out, and you couldn't find you couldn't find the lyrics. If the lyrics weren't printed in the liner notes, you had to listen to that album again and again and again and try to write them out and figure that out. And then it's like you would wait. Mm-hmm. You'd wait for a magazine like Ice in later years, or you'd wait until it showed up in your newspaper. I mean, you wouldn't know what they're, when they were coming to town necessarily, until it was in your local paper.
Or when the first single would go to radio.
Exactly. Just one day, I remember being in a taxi cab. Going up the FDR Drive in Manhattan and hearing River of Dreams. Boy, everything is coming back to Billy Joel. But I remember...
Hi, Ted.
But at that point, you knew when that was coming out, right?
Probably.
You had to.
Probably, but still, it wasn't, there wasn't... The, 93, I wasn't on the internet. Were you?
See, I go back to... No, but I go back to hearing Modern Woman.
Uh-huh.
Right.
On the soundtrack of...
Yeah, when that was a single.
Ruthless People, was that?
Yes, it was.
Yeah, Ruthless People, that's right.
But it was also the lead single off of Greatest Hits Volume 1 and 2.
No, it was the lead single off The Bridge.
Yeah, it wasn't on Greatest Hits 1 and 2.
Was it on Greatest Hits?
No, it was
What was the lead single off of...
You're Only Human.
That was You're Only Human.
You're Only Human. Oh, right, okay.
But You're Only Human came with a big lead up, and that was, there was the video debut. I don't think there was a video for Modern Woman.
No, there wasn't.
I don't remember.
But I just I had to catch it at the right time on the radio. Yeah, I vividly remember that.
Yeah, I mean, here's another example that you wouldn't think that I would bring up, was that when Tunnel of Love was released, that there was a huge push on the two New York stations, on Z100 and WPLJ, for the day they were going to debut Brilliant Disguise.
It was like a bolo tie promotion, right?
it was a bolo tie promotion?
Yeah. And I'm sure NEW was doing something as well. NEW and XR and K-Rock were doing something as well.
Sure, but it was the kind of thing where it was like, tune in.
But you didn't know those stations existed.
Tune in. It was like, tune in at this time to hear this song. But it's right. But it's not only about that. So it's also about the mystique that's kind of gone, and also the relationship that a band has to have with their fans now, which is not something.
I think there's a lot to be. Yeah, there's a lot in there. Like not just mystique, but effort.
Yeah.
I mean, remember the era when I was going to a lot of concerts for free. It's very easy to become just completely blasé about that whole experience.
Yeah, 1996, which was when I was running a store for pretty much the entire year, I went to 18 concerts, and I paid for one of them.
And did you leave any of them before they were over?
No.
Because I walked out of a ton of concerts.
Because these were all bands that I wanted to see.
Same here.
Okay.
I saw, I in the summer of 92, I think it was, I saw James Taylor and left maybe 20 minutes into the show.
Wow.
Really?
I was reviewing it. And the thing, like, part of it was that it was exactly like listening to a CD, except some guy kept yelling Mexico. But the other part is just that, like, when you're handed that stuff, what difference does it make? And I think that goes with what we're talking about in terms of being an avid collector. You know, anything you want pretty much is a click away. Like the worst that'll happen is that you'll spend a few months searching for some stupid bootleg that you want. And then you get it. And then, well, maybe you don't even listen to it all the way through.
Right. That's definitely the case. I mean, I think of, you know, I've never been like the, I need to have, Like when colored vinyls started being, you know, limited edition colored vinyls of stuff, and especially with me and the Beatles, you know, I never felt I needed that. I didn't need every single form of packaging. I just needed every single song. And if, you know, maybe if there was like an alternative mix of this or, you know, an earlier take, I'd want to hear that. But if it wasn't, you know, that great, big deal. I just wanted like the best versions, and now like with me and you know, and my Springsteen bootlegs, I actually deleted a couple because I realized I just didn't need them.
I am stunned.
I didn't need those particular shows because I had I kept the songs like you know, you had given me that that one from the 2005 tour, so I just like kept the songs that were premieres at those particular shows, but I already had. You know, from the Magic Tour and the Working on a Dream tours, I already had those shows, enough of those shows that I had been to in full that I didn't need another version of this song from a show that I had no personal connection to.
Yeah.
But like a lot of the stuff on the 78 tour, you know, I went through this period where I had to get, I was so obsessed with the 78 tour that I wanted to hear every single concert possible that had been available on that, because just like the evolutions of Backstreet Sad Eyes, for example, you know, I was just so fascinated by what he was doing every night on that song.
I feel bad for kids who are growing up now, because they're never going to know the thrill of ordering a Japanese import.
Right. Yes. Oh, God, yes.
You know, of spending $45.
Right. Something that had three tracks on it or something.
Right.
Yeah.
And like I remember going to Tower and seeing like the import CD singles of Matthew Sweet Records and saying, "Oh my God, here's, you know, I've got this song already on it, but he's got the demo versions of these other songs."
Oh my God, the money I would plunk down happily for an album where even like, well, okay, here's how about this? What were the artists that started that for you?
That started the,
like, what was
have
the,
to get everything?
What was the first artist where you were like, I have to go and get the import, and I have to go and get this version, and this version, and this version? Or I have to collect every album, you know?
It would be like something like Matthew Sweet in the early 90s, when I, for the first time, I really
late,
had...
That late, huh?
Because I didn't have tons of disposable income.
But you grew up on... But you're Jewish and grew up on Long Island.
But I was working to save up for college. So that wasn't there. I mean, I kind of was spending my money on building my collection in general.
Yeah. Okay.
But I didn't have the money to go and collect. So it really wasn't until the 90s when, I was working in record stores and had just very easy access to these things.
What about you, Jeff?
Well, you know, by the time CDs were pervasive, I was writing, and so I had kind of a I didn't have to pay for a lot of this stuff. I'm thinking now, though, of the way I met Christopher Cross, which was that this was the early 90s, and he had lost his record deal, and I was thinking about this as we were leading up to the show, and I was trying to remember why I loved the record that he put out in 1985 so much, and I just can't. It's like a lot of Billy Joel stuff. I just can't reconnect to whatever I was feeling at the time, but I loved that record, and he was a big deal to me. And I used to buy Billboard anytime I got a chance, which is another thing that I don't think kids growing up now will ever really understand, was, as you alluded to a few minutes ago, that if you wanted to know anything about a band that you liked and they weren't being covered in Rolling Stone or whatever, which, you know, is a pretty narrow spectrum.
Right.
You had to resort to other methods, and one of those was buying Billboard. And Billboard had a section that told you who was recording. So I saw that he was recording in Texas, and I don't remember how I did it. I ended up talking to some engineer at this place, some poor engineer at this studio, and he ended up giving me a P.O. box, and I wrote to Christopher Cross at this address and told him what his music had meant to me, and that I was interested in either reviewing the record, the upcoming record, or doing a feature on him or whatever. And I got back this incredible 5-page letter telling me how what I had written was like a glass of water after 5 years in the desert.
Wow.
And yeah, it was pretty amazing.
Do you still have that letter?
I don't think I do.
Oh, no.
I had it for a long time. It was pretty crazy. Anyway, he sent me a copy of the album, which only came out in Japan, and if I had wanted to buy it, I'm sure I would have had to spend a lot of money. This was kind of the beginning of Japanese labels throwing money at washed-up adult contemporary stars. I think I have some really random CD singles by artists like Paul Carrick, and I mean, I was a pretty stupid completist for a while there, but when I was really most passionate about that, I don't think I had to buy those things.
Wow. See, I was so young. I mean, I was like 12 when I had my first artist that I was like, I want to get everything that I can find.
I was like that with Billy Joel too, but that was in like 84, so it was between, you know, it was
after
like
an innocent,
you know,
man, and before
the bridge. It was around the
and when you're that age, 3 years is a fucking eternity. And so
there weren't imports and tons of stuff there. Everything that came out was, you know, what came out was available
for Billy.
Well, but also, I remember, I think it was during this period that the remaster of Cold Spring Harbor came out, you know, the corrected version. Mm-hmm. And it was still, like, I remember dragging my grandfather with me to the library or something to get a vinyl copy of Street Life Serenade, you know. Things just weren't that pervasive. You know, there was no Amazon. You still had to hunt for stuff, even if it was for somebody like Billy Joel.
And for me, it was you know, when I got into the Beatles as a kid, I just wanted to hear every single thing by him. But again, you know, everything that was out. You didn't have to look for it. You know, you were talking about like ordering and looking for imports. You know, for me, it was just different. You know, I didn't even know until, I guess, the CDs came out in 87 that they had, or 86, that they had separate releases, but up until Sergeant Pepper.
Sure.
You know.
Oh, the mono ones? The British one,
the capital. Was, please me, and that there was a difference between the Parlophone and the with the Beatles stuff. For me, and another thing that you'll hear us talk about in the interview, is that the fanzine culture that was something that I never got into. Because, you know, I think of, Will Harris, our colleague, and how obsessive he is about power pop. And I think of, like, when I was kind of dallying in that in the 94 to 96 or so, when I'd see these Yellow Pills compilations and I'd buy those. Right. And there's a lot of great stuff on there, but I never thought, or I knew that this was I guess I had learned at some point that this was a fanzine and all these bands, you know, that's where you would read about them and that's how you could get their music. But, you know, cause I was working in a record store, I was so busy getting so much other stuff that I just never had the time to get into the fanzine culture that would have, made me a power pop completist. Wasn't
zine dead by the time those CDs came out?
Maybe. I never knew. That's just it. I never, but just in general, like that type of thing, you know, like that was the only way that you could really hear about this stuff that wasn't being covered was that there were fanzines and it was an underground. And I just wasn't part of that because I was working in a chain mall store.
Right. I just remember being 12 and finding out that there was a store in the city in Greenwich Village that I only knew about. They specialized in mainly Japanese and British imports, and I knew that I found out this was the only store that had those, and it was like a completely different world. Like all this stuff that you couldn't get in America, you could get at this store. And I remember dragging my mom down to Greenwich Village, making her sit with me.
How much did you spend?
I probably didn't spend that much. I probably wound up getting two items that were like, you know, $30 each or something like that. Although that was a lot of money, you know.
Yeah, that's insane.
You know, but it was the kind of thing like I saved up for it, you know. Like I saved up and was like, we're going to this store. It was so exciting to be able to find like this. It was like this treasure chest that was opened up in the village. It was so,
and there's nothing like that now. Amazon is the treasure chest, and the thrill evaporates halfway through. You're listening to the album that you downloaded,
and you can't. I mean, there's no hunting it because it's like if I need a rare track that was only released in like Jason Faulkner's stuff, you know, like Jason Faulkner's stuff. All of his stuff is pretty much released in Japan exclusively, because he's a fucknut and won't release it on his, you know, independently from his website. But it's like, rather, you know, there was an excitement, even though you had to spend so much money to go and get the fucking Japanese import. Now you can just search for it online and get it, and you got it, and there's no, that thrill of being rewarded is not there, you know?
Yeah. I just remember, I was looking at my, I'm up here with my CD racks.
That huge wall.
I felt a twinge of shame remembering that I bought a Night Ranger import.
And you're making fun of me for having a prog phase.
Hey,
well, at least the Night Ranger album is over quickly.
Good point.
What do you mean there were only three songs on those albums? Close to the Edge, Siberian Kintru, and You and I, and Close to the Edge. There you go, three songs.
It's got you there, Jeff.
Okay, here's one for you. Which of rock's sacred cows have you never been able to get into, no matter how many times you've tried?
Bruce Springsteen.
Richard Thompson.
The Rolling Stones.
Jason, Dave, I knew you were going to say
Springsteen. Dave takes it on the nuts twice there.
Three times. Springsteen, Richard Thompson, and the Rolling Stones.
I mean, I have a million of those, to be honest.
Right.
Bob Dylan.
No shit.
Well, I mean,
no, that's not surprising. That's not surprising at all.
Well, no, I mean, I like a clean. I like a nice.
And I don't mean that in a mocking way.
I don't care if you do.
Oh, here's one. Neil Young.
Same reason. Have
you ever been able to get to Richard Thompson and Neil Young, Jeff?
Richard Thompson is. You know, I haven't spent as much time trying to get into Richard Thompson.
I can get behind Richard Thompson. Guys.
But it's his voice.
Neil Young is why I can't get into Bob Dylan.
See, now, but Neil Young is just, like, it isn't, you know, Bob Dylan can't sing, but he can write. And Neil Young, I feel like, is, I mean, I just don't get it. I don't.
Interesting.
I feel like, he's just a guy with Asperger's banging on a guitar. I don't understand it.
Okay. For me, it's Bowie.
Yeah, Bowie's got his moments for me. I have Let's Dance on my iPod.
The greatest hits, you know, the original Changes One Bowie record, a couple of cuts from Let's Dance, and Ziggy Stardust, and that's all I need.
His stuff is very cold.
That's exactly why I don't like it.
And that's what always throws me off. It's just so clinical, and it always feels like he's striking a pose just to see what'll happen.
Yeah.
And there's no warmth there, and I don't know.
That's most of it with me, yeah.
What a great way of describing it.
I've always felt that his changing of personas was a disguise for the fact that he didn't have any interesting songs.
You know, like, Paul Simon is a guy who strikes different poses, and you can hear him.
He strikes different musical poses and tries out different things. He doesn't play roles.
But I think that something like Graceland was very much designed to jumpstart his creativity, and that's probably the same motivation for the stuff that Bowie does. It's just that Bowie is so clinical. There's no heat in his music.
Oh, come on, Jeff. Right. Graceland was some guy sitting in his rich apartment in the city listening to African music.
I think that with Paul Simon, you can hear a genuine curiosity in song form. And Bowie, it feels like he's just playing dress-up.
Yeah, he's jumping on trends, and, you know, he's been able to...
We're trying to create trends.
No, because all that stuff was already there in the underground. You know, like when maybe like in the early days, the Spaceman thing. But, you know, the Thin White Duke, he's not the first white guy to sing soul. Tin Machine was not bad industrial music, which is a genre that I've always thought was pretty bad anyway.
Mentioning Bowie, I always loved that after he put out Low.
Yes.
Nick Lowe put out an EP called Bowie with no E at the end.
Right.
I find it frustrating that I don't like some of these bands that I mentioned. Like
I do too.
You know, like Springsteen, for example. Like, why don't I like somebody more that goes out and plays 3-hour shows where they're different every night? And I mean, the only thing I like about not being a Springsteen fan is the, you know, lifting.
You know? No, I don't, because, you know, I always try to think of, like, where somebody comes from in their musical tastes. And where you're coming from, it doesn't make sense for that. You know, and again, I'm not saying that to mock you.
Well, what do you mean? Because of like pop sensibilities or?
Yeah, exactly. Your musical sensibilities were informed by something else. And, you know, I also don't think that the stuff that I know about you, like for me, it's very much a lyrical connection, and the type of things that he sings about are very much a lot of the questions that I've had.
Okay.
It is like a misery of the music question, you know, which came first. You know, did I ask those questions because I was a Springsteen fan, or did I become a Springsteen fan because he was asking those questions? I know that it all kind of came together at the start of my, you know, that I first became a Springsteen fan as I was learning, as I was becoming politically aware, which was 84, 85. So that there is largely that, and, you know, and then there's the, you know, as I got older, and I've had spells where I just, like, didn't really listen to him a lot, but the last 5 years or so, I've been listening to him a lot because I've really been analyzing how he goes about his shows and how he sets up the concerts and takes you through a variety of themes, and that all builds up to the moment when the house lights comes on and Born to Run starts, and it's just this huge release. And the fact that he's pretty much the only one who can still do that, who will sequence, who will very deliberately sequence a show to take you on this journey.
Well, and play to a mass audience while he's doing it.
Right. But I even think of, like, you know, and you can't expect this of, like, a band with one or two albums out, you know, who are just thinking these things and thinking these things through. But even if, you know, you see... You know, the Stones, you know, you pretty much know what you're going to get. And the last four songs are going to be Satisfaction, Brown Sugar, Jumpin' Jack Flash, or whatever. And that's fine. And that's great. But, you know, the way that he does it you know, he start, you know, like how he flows. Billy Joel was also very, very good at it for a long time. But with Bruce, it became more about understanding where he's coming from, as much as just his songs and this incredible respect I have for the way that he does that. Jason, you awake?
Huh? What happened? No, I.
Here's a sacred cow for me. I want to know what you guys think of this. Leonard Cohen.
Honestly have not had enough exposure to him. And that's the way I've been about a lot of the artists that you love that are on my list of artists that I need to listen to more, like Randy Newman.
I feel like I should love Leonard Cohen, and I never.
Oh, you don't? Okay, I gotcha.
It's the same thing with Dylan and Waits and Randy Newman and Neil Young. If you can get past the voice, you can get into it. I'm not a huge poetry person, although I do have a very strong lyrical bent. I'm not a big fan of setting poetry to music. I can respect what he does a lot, and certainly, you know, like Fairport Convention doing Suzanne or Jeff Buckley doing Hallelujah, you know, those are Famous Blue Raincoat, you know, there are great songs in there that need other people to bring out their strengths.
Newman's voice is on the same continuum, but he's one of those guys. Like, his voice, warmth is very important to me, and I think Newman's voice has a lot of warmth to it. And he really can't sing, but he's trying. There's a certain chutzpah to the way he sings. You know what I mean? Like, he...
Well, there's the question of, is he genuine, or is he being... Or is it an affectation?
Well, his characters aren't genuine. His characters are purposely
untrustworthy. But I mean, like, you know, okay, yeah, he grew up in New Orleans. You know, he's always singing, like, trying to sing like Fats Domino. But, you know, for... you know, and yeah, he... I mean, I once read an interview with him where he had that a conversation with Stephen Sondheim, who said, you know, well, you do all these kind of things that kind of betray your heritage as a... You know, like in terms of his use of rhymes, you know, Stephen Sondheim is very perfect with his rhymes. Every single rhyme, you know, everyone is absolutely
perfect. I saw
one
of these interviews too, where Sondheim kind of busted his chops for not using perfect rhyme.
Right. And he says, yeah, but you're forgetting that I'm from New Orleans, where Fats Domino's would, you know, rhyme New Orleans with shoes. You know, so yeah, if you remember, if sometimes when you have to listen, you have to think, oh, right, that's right. He grew up in New Orleans and has, you know, that's not necessarily an affectation. It's just the stuff that he loves and how it's coming out. No different from when the Beatles would sing in American accents.
He really grew up in LA, but I see what you're saying. Yeah. I don't know. I just feel like for someone who loves lyrics as much as I do, I should really like Leonard Cohen's music more than I do. And
but it's the difference between poetry and lyrics.
Yeah. And it's also, I don't know. Something about his stuff has always left me cold. I bought that, what was it called, the Tower of Song?
Mm-hmm.
The tribute record that came out that Billy Joel did.
Light as a Breeze.
Light as a Breeze, yeah. I thought that was great.
Me too.
But I don't know. He's one that I feel like I should go back and try again. Because it took me a long time to appreciate Dylan. And maybe someday I'll be able to appreciate Richard Thompson. Waits is another animal entirely, because he started off very, very accessible.
Right.
Right.
Mm-hmm. He got growlier.
And you, yeah, you know that now he's just fucking with you.
Exactly. I mean, I'm one of those people who does prefer those first few Waits records. Up to Rain Dogs. I love Rain Dogs, but like the last 15 years of, or 25 years, I guess, of Tom Waits records, it's like, okay, we get it. You like Mules.
I think the first time I heard Bone Machine, I'm pretty sure I pissed my pants.
I don't even know. I don't even recall if I got that one.
I think that's the one with the song called Earth Died Screaming on it, and that's pretty much what the record sounds like.
This broadcast is probably endorsed by 5-time Grammy Award winner Michael McDonald.
Our endorsement for this month is American Legacies, which is a collaboration between the Del McCoury Band and the Preservation Hall Jazz Band. It's an incredible stew of Americana with bluegrass and Dixieland jazz, finding common musical ground and performed with reverence and joy I know that Jeff agrees with me on this. We were both raving about this on Twitter a few weeks ago. And he even recently interviewed Del McCoury for Popdos, and we'll link to that in the show notes. And there was a line that Del said in that interview that I thought was pretty telling. He said that the name that they gave to the sound is Mardi Gras, which I thought was very accurate. If you're familiar with Springsteen's the Seeger Sessions album, it's a very similar sound in the way that the horns mix with the banjos and the mandolins and the acoustic guitars. But it differs in the sound in that there's a little more space in the arrangements, and instead of being performed by versatile session musicians, it's played by people who are masters of their genres and have devoted their lives to preserving some of 20th century America's greatest musical traditions.
Just a few more.
That's going to do it for this episode of the Popdos podcast, but the discussion doesn't end here. Let's have your answers to the questions we posed in the comments over in the show notes at popdos.com. You can find back episodes of the show on iTunes, and while you're there, please leave us a review because it helps give the show greater exposure, and you can follow us on Twitter at Popdos. And one more thing, Jason, Jeff, and I recently did an interview with Todd Stump over at the Brown Tweed Society. We talked mostly about the current state of pop culture consumption and criticism. It's a long read and it's broken up into two parts, but again, it's very worthwhile. Some really great questions asked, and we will link to both parts in the show notes. We will be back with the podcast next month. Not really sure what we're going to talk about, but I'm sure we will have some surprise worked out for you. Bye.
Pop-tose.
Okay. Jeff, do you have any questions?
What is the capital of South Dakota?
Bismarck.
Pierre. No, Bismarck is North Dakota.
I don't know.
Two competing answers.
I heard Dakota. In my opinion, South Dakota doesn't exist.
And yet that's the only one that gets tourism because it has Mount Rushmore.
I don't know anybody from South Dakota, so I don't think it exists.
I do. Sean Colvin. You don't know Sean Colvin?
I've never met him.
From South Dakota. Why do you know this?
Because.
Fandom.
Yeah, exactly. Yes, exactly. That's what we're talking about. It's fandom. It's the things that we care about.